Is your team not performing well? Is morale low and turnover high? Are you falling further behind the competition? I'm here to help. I'm your host, Shaney, and this is the Leadership Show, where business strategy and culture finally meet, and we make the long-awaited shift from rhetoric to results. I promise I'm not your typical boring leadership consultant, and I will help you get your shift together. Let's do this. Welcome, Leadershifters, to another episode of the Leadership Show with Shaney. Happy New Year. It's 2020 now, 2020, which is like a Buck Rogers year, isn't it? Well, you are in for a treat today on my first podcast of 2020. Let me introduce to you Jim Down, the CEO of Connemara, and we will get into explaining what his business does in just a second. But first, I think the best way to introduce Jim is for me to read one of his favorite quotes. If your business depends on you, you don't own a business. You have a job. And it's the worst job in the world because you're working for a lunatic.
That's exactly right, yeah.
So, Jim, welcome to the Leadership Show.
Tell us
a little bit about your background before we get into the meat of stuff, because folks, this is a man who has shifted careers several different times and has a very interesting professional history, and what he started doing is not very similar to what he's doing these days. So start us off with your engineering days and move us forward.
Sure, Shaney, thank you. I was an electrical engineer. I graduated from Purdue University. I figured I'd be working as an electrical engineer all my life, except I wound up taking this class my senior year about personal finance, which basically was how to, you know, balance your checkbook, how to, you know, what's life insurance and that sort of thing. But they did cover something on investments. And at that point in time, the equity options were just beginning to start trading. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got the bug of saying, you know,
you got hooked.
Yeah, I did. It was like, this is really interesting. The most interesting part about it was that you could actually model it. So I understood the math because I was an electrical engineer.
Yeah.
So that's where I got my first start. I did work as an electrical engineer for Honeywell Avionics up in Minneapolis for a while. And then during that time, I was recruited then by the Central Intelligence Agency in Langley.
And nice.
I worked as an engineer there. It's very technical oriented, always, you know, that business.
Yeah. Can you tell us what you did, or if you did, you'd have to kill us still all these years later?
No, I don't have to kill you. I worked with the telemetry. We would decode telemetry from intercontinental ballistic missiles of the Soviet Union. So this is a while ago. So that was our job. That basically, it was a great, very interesting, because you're verifying the nuclear treaties that were in place, make sure that they weren't doing something outside their bounds of what they're allowed to do by the treaty. So there was that. And then, but all during that time, I was trading options as a retail investor, which was a bad idea. lost some money that way. But then
yeah.
I figured, you know, who's somebody else is making this money?
Well, you know, back in the day, information was not shared equitably in the market, right? So make the reference to retail investors back then, retail investors were at a huge disadvantage to institutional investors. They still are to some extent, but less so, right?
Yeah, it was very much a huge. The disadvantage also was just, you know, time and place, you know, information. The second thing was that the bid-ask spread for options was, you know, a 16th or an eighth, which was, you know, $6.25 or, you know, $12.50. So, you know, I mean, that's a huge edge, you know, to be giving up every time you enter into the market, along with the commissions were like very expensive also. So $20, $30, $40.
Right. No TD Ameritrade and E-Trade and all those low cost brokerages back then either.
Zero commissions. I thought it was great when I was on the floor that the clearing firm only charged me $1 a contract.
Right.
That was awesome. You know, you trade up, you know, 100,000 contracts a year. You know, it's that finally got crushed down to, you know,
yeah.
anyways, but yeah.
So tell us about your days on the SIBO and the CBOT. And for those of you who are not familiar with the institute, those trading institutions in Chicago, if you could just 2-second overview of what they both are for the listeners here.
Sure. The CBOE, or the Chicago Board Options Exchange, was the first exchange in the United States to list equity options or options on shares. Mm-hmm. So, and that started in 1973. I got to the floor in 1981. So it was still really young and really and kind of a bit of a Wild West show in that regard. But it was a place where you could go with a few $1,000, you know, of your own, lease a seat, become a market maker. And with any kind of luck or judgment, you could do quite well for yourself. And then the Chicago Board of Trade, which is just across the street, at the time after they were in the same building, but is the old commodity exchange that traded mostly at the time grains and then also treasury bonds. So they were futures contracts versus the option contracts, which were traded on equities across the street. So I was a local trader there. The reason why I traded both places is that the Chicago Board of Trade started the Chicago Board Options Exchange back in 1973. And if you bought a Chicago Board of Trade membership, you could trade in both exchanges, which is what I actually ended up doing.
Nice.
Yeah,
those buildings fondly from my days in Chicago, walking up and down Wacker.
Yeah, there was a nice ebb and flow. You know, the equities are usually busy first half of the year, first quarter of the year anyways. And then the grains would pick up with the planting season. So you could, if you wanted liquidity, you would trade that stocks in the spring, and then you'd walk across the street and hopefully there'd be a drought or something to cause, you know, some disruption in the grain markets, and you could trade there during the summer. And then once the harvest starts coming in, you know what the harvest is, then you go back to trade stocks about September.
Yeah. So let's get out of nostalgia mode and get into Connemara mode. Tell us, what does the business do? You know, who are its customers? And how and why did you start it, including kind of the bootstrap story? Because I think that is really interesting to some of the listeners, because we got a lot of entrepreneurs who subscribe to, you know, sort of the leadership philosophy. And most people think, oh, if I'm going to be an entrepreneur, I've got to go get some VC money or at least, you know, some friends and family round or something. Yeah. So I'm sort of interested in all those things.
Yeah. So I was lucky in a few ways. First of all, just to step back in time, one more time, is that all during the time that I was trading options, I also was writing software to value options. So, so that's kind of the link that happened there. Why Connemara came about. But just quickly about Connemara Systems, we've been in business over 20 years. We provide software engineering services to capital markets pretty much exclusively. Our clients are proprietary trading firms, brokerages, exchanges, and startup exchanges. So anyone on the front side of the trading, which is what I understand, has been our client of ours. From there, I started Connemara though back probably in 1998. As I said, I was writing software for myself. And the floor after 1987 crash, the floor, it changed. The market changed. The bid-ask spreads tightened up. As an independent market maker without using anyone else's capital, it became very competitive. It was the time when the bigger groups, trading groups, moved in, and just they had a different risk profile than someone like myself would have. So being able to get on the trade was hard. So I owned a membership, leased it out, and thought I'd, you know, take a stab at writing software for other people. And that's how we started. At the same time in 1998, what was happening, the markets were evolving away from this open outcry, you know, standing in the pit and yelling and screaming all day to electronic trading. And I would like to think I was looking forward, but it was more of these things that this looks like an opportunity that, you know, I can use this skill you know, to that I've learned over the last 17 years that of writing software for capital markets, and maybe, you know, with the markets evolving, I won't go the way of of the floor trader and just be put out of business.
Yeah. So let me pause for a second, because I follow a futurist named Bob Johansson from the Institute of the Future in San Francisco. They're a think tank, and they don't predict the future. They study what's happening, and they identify trends that they think are highly likely to burgeon, right? And so one of the things he says is, the future is already here. It's just not widely distributed.
That's very
good. So what you just said is a perfect example of that. Like, you could see the trend, you know, things going from outcry to more electronic, and you were on the leading edge of it, taking advantage of that trend.
Yeah, and it was sort of fortuitous, because it was more one of these things where it was getting harder and harder to make money trading on the floor. It was just being, you know, sucked away. The edge was being sucked away because, like we mentioned earlier, you know, information was becoming, you know, more widely distributed. So you lost your advantage of being in time and place advantage in the market. Yep. For standing there and risking your own capital. So, you know, I as I said, I believe I was fortunate, because, you know, at that point I was able to see around me this change that was coming. And I was also kind of had the right skill set. So when I did my first work as an independent consultant, I found, what I really found was that I could write software for clients. That was not a problem. But it was a little bit different than writing it for myself, because I was not trained as a programmer. I was trained as a circuits designer. But the what I did find out is I knew a lot about trading. I could really, I understood what the client was saying to me when they said they wanted to do this strategy, or they wanted to do this, you know, some other sort of system they wanted to build. Within probably, you know, 10 minutes, I had it mapped out in my mind how this was actually going to work. So that was really fortunate that I was, you know, kind of had that. So I found that was really my strong suit. So rather than just writing code, I actually, and that's part of what Connemara brings to the table today, is just a deep domain expertise in capital markets. And we understand what our clients are trying to do.
Sure. So take us through the trajectory of growing the business over 21 years from, you know, inception. Oh, okay, I'm writing software and I can actually turn this into a business.
Yeah.
Today, where you're hiring people who are smarter than you. In some areas, right? Because that's not how all business people start, surely.
Yeah. Right. So. What I guess if there was a mini shift, if you want to talk about it, was the idea early on where I said, well, yes, I can write software, but I actually know a lot about capital markets.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than, but I can hire other people to write software better than I can.
Sure.
I can explain to them what they need to write, the programs they need to write.
Sure.
So that was the one case. So again, we were in a really fortunate place of this market evolving, you know, kind of right place, right time, where there was a pretty good demand for software engineers and that knew about capital markets, especially in Chicago. I mean, there was a lot of demand for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, you know, one by one, just started hiring people. We had projects, you know, successful, branched out to New York, did some projects on the New York Stock Exchange, and, you know, just sort of over time, just slowly, you know, from the bootstrap, just reinvested back in the business and just grew the business from there.
Okay. And so one of the things that we talked about pre-call was 4 or 5 years ago, you had a pretty significant shift in how you look at running the business, such that it's more important to work on the business than in the business. Tell us about that journey and what changes that has led you to take in the leadership of your company.
Yeah, and this is the part I'm really finding interesting, and what really gets me excited in the morning to, you know, come into work and do this, is that, I read a blog post by a fellow by the name of Andrew Wilkinson, And it was called Lazy Leadership. And I would highly recommend it to anybody that's in my position.
Lazy Leadership, okay.
Lazy Leadership, Andrew Wilkinson. And there was a couple takeaways from there, but one of them was that I needed to stop working in my business. Mm-hmm. Right? And then I needed to start working on my business. And, you know, the other point he made that was that if you don't like doing something in your business, you're probably not that good at it. You're not doing your best. So you should probably hire somebody and leverage that person's talent who wants to do that job.
Yep.
You know, to grow your business. So that to me was like, you know, that was kind of like a watershed moment or a shift that is just like, wait a minute. Okay. I kind of had this wrong for the last 15 years or whatever.
Yeah. And was it hard to let go of that stuff once you had the mindset shift? Did action follow easily?
It actually did, because it just made sense to me. But there was a separate, you know, he references a couple of things also. So it wasn't like an overnight thing. So he also references Ray Dalio's Principles book.
Yep.
And I went into that rabbit hole reading that book, which is it's highly recommended, but it is a bit of a rabbit hole. But what really got added to this feeling of mine that I needed to change was that Dalio describes business as a machine. So as an engineer, that makes sense to me. You know, it has inputs and I have desired outputs. So what I need to do is build a machine that actually takes the inputs, whatever the constraints of those inputs might be, and then build a machine that gives me the desired outputs. So it's just a feedback mechanism, or like if you do an engineering or, you know, whatever. So, you know, what I ended up doing is that, looking at my business and stepping back from that business and saying, okay, if my business is a machine, and I visualize my business as having a box with gears in it, where talent goes in, clients go in, and money comes out the other side.
Okay.
That's the way I look at it. But I realized there was a couple of gears that were actually missing. I never had a sales team. I mean, never. Never did any marketing. We were all word of mouth, and we were really successful. We just were word of mouth. I mean, I always used to say that we were the most important software engineering firm in capital markets that no one has ever heard about.
Right.
We did some really large scale projects. Excuse me. But like,
and that works until it doesn't, right? And then you start to get nervous about the pipeline and
all that ups and downs. Absolutely.
Yeah.
We were able to always cobble it together. You know, that was especially in the services business, right?
Yeah.
So I didn't have a sales team, and I said, well, I hate doing sales. I don't like actually the sales process. I like closing deals, and that's probably because I was a trader, but the sales process, don't like.
Yeah.
So the first kind of shift was like, okay, I need to take 18 months here and find me a salesperson. Who can I find? You know, and I went through quite a long interviewing process. So maybe that was actually not an exact shift, and maybe it did take longer than I think, but it's about 18 months that I searched for a salesperson.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be a big deal. Because
you were shifting your model for business development from referral to, you know, full sales, you know, prospecting, blah, 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 all the way.
Yeah. And I had no marketing team, so I was able to, you know, after I had a sales team, I had no marketing gear, you know, that was going to put leads into my sales team that they could close. Mm-hmm. So I went out and I found a crack marketing team, you know, so that really focused just on capital markets. And that was the next one. I'd also never had a board of advisors, or, you know, I never had a board telling me what to do because we were bootstrapped. So I had no one. You know, there's a double-edged sword of having a board, right? And having investors. Yep. They are pretty smart individuals that you can bounce ideas off of. I didn't have that. This is just me sitting here thinking, oh, that might be a good idea to do that.
Yeah. Have an informal board of directors of?
Nothing.
No, nothing. So is that something you would do differently and recommend if others are going to bootstrap and you don't have sort of an advisory board to find some folks?
I absolutely would. Without question. Because also I, And this is fairly recent. Within this last year, I actually, instituted the board of advisors, and we've had a meeting or two, and hey, it's good ideas. I mean, I was just on the phone with one of them yesterday, kicking around some ideas that, that I want to got some good input. So that's kind of the shift that I went through. Went from realizing that I can't, that I should be hiring people that do things that I don't like to do. That I should be working on the business, and my business is a machine. And then look at that machine and see what parts I'm actually missing inside of it, and try and design that machine to actually have those parts. So that's where we are.
That's awesome. And so let's pause for a second. Leadershifters, as you listen to this, think about your own businesses, whether they're small or your business is a division or a niche within a larger company. What does your machine look like? And are all of your gears present? And if they're all present, are they all working seamlessly, right? Is it a well-oiled machine, if you will? And be honest about it, and take a look at, where are you missing gears, and where you maybe have the wrong gears hooked up in your machine, because absolutely that's super important to have everything moving, and to then let the gears do their jobs, right? So talk to us about how you were able to, sort of step back and let the people with the expertise in marketing and sales do their jobs, sort of with your oversight, but not with your day-to-day micromanagement, which might have been more prevalent in the areas that you were interested, in more of the engineering pieces of the business.
Well, on the engineering side, I mean, one of the things that I'm really proud about here is at Connemara is that the engineers that we hire, when they come in, we give them great latitude in their decision making. I don't know. Well, you'd have to ask my employees, but I don't think I'm a micromanager, but I may be in some, as I think about it, sometimes I am when I need to be. But what we do there with our engineers is we actually allow them to make mistakes. I writing software is not the easiest thing in the world, so you're going to make mistakes. So I've tried to take that approach of being able to make mistakes and use and not penalize someone for making mistakes, and go forward with that with my salesman. He had a ramp up of a year, before, and you kind of have to expect that. And he was really nervous about it. I was like, just don't worry about it. You're doing the right thing. This is going to click.
Yeah. What you're describing is the culture that you've created within your organization, which is one of the biggest shifts that I work with companies to make, are to shift the cultures. In fact, my informal tagline for the Leadershift Project is I help leaders and organizations get their shift together. And mostly it's around culture, because a lot of times companies have not given sufficient thought to the environment that they're creating. So it's like if instead of a machine, let's think of the company as a greenhouse, right? Well, if we don't have the right air in the greenhouse, or the right nutrients in the plants in the greenhouse, like the garden in the greenhouse is not gonna thrive. And same thing with culture. We can have the nicest seeds in the world, great ideas, whatever, and they will not thrive if the culture isn't right. So number one, I'm hearing you say that you have a culture that doesn't punish mistakes.
That's right.
Which is huge, because how else are people going to learn?
Yeah, and that's the way we see it. And actually, in 20 years, we've only actually let go one person.
That's amazing.
We have a really good hiring process, but we're very careful about how we hire. But
yeah.
But besides that, and we also had some of my oldest, our longest employees that left and come back. So
that's a high form of compliment, isn't it?
Yes, I'm very proud of that. We call it the Rumspringa, after the Amish. That the Amish have a tradition where if you're a young man or young woman, you can leave the community once and come back.
I did that at Goldman Sachs, but we use financial jargon. We call that a repo, right?
Yeah, yeah, right. It goes out, it comes back overnight. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I repoed.
Yeah.
Awesome. What other elements of your culture do you think have allowed you to attract and retain such great folks?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think that idea about making mistakes, I think it is number one.
Yeah, huge, huge. Most companies are so punitive with mistakes, even if they don't do anything actively, there's a subtext of don't fuck up again.
Yeah, exactly. So the other part was when I started hiring people and, you know, having employees, is that I wanted to have an environment where you could have a nice balance between your family and your outside activities and your work. So, and a lot of people give that lip service, but for me, it was this idea because, you know, my wife also works, mm-hmm. and we raised two children together, and that, but there was this, what I noticed was that this time at the beginning of the day and the end of the day, like a couple hours window there, is really important for families.
Sure.
You know, it's the school play or it's the doctor's appointment or it's that, you know. So we really kind of instituted this idea where I need 8 hours out of you for the day. But if you need to come in at 10 and leave at 6, that's fine. If you want to come in at 8 and leave at 4, that's fine too. I kind of need you between 10 and 2, but at the office. But now we're a lot remote now. But that's how we started. But that just carried through.
That's great. So treating people like responsible adults. Imagine that.
Well, the interesting thing about software development is the code works or it doesn't. So,
right.
So if you're not doing your work, you know, it's pretty evident. We haven't really seen that, but so we're very liberal on our remote policies. I think I've got a couple employees out today, remote. I think one's going to bring his daughter in for Girl Scout cookies later to sell all Girl Scout cookies.
Ah, Thin Mints for everybody.
Yeah. Another round of Thin Mints for everyone.
Or I like the ones with the coconut and the chocolate. What are those called?
Oh, I don't know. I'm the Savannah.
They've got the hole in the middle, but they're like chocolate and coconut. Yeah.
I like the Savannahs. That's what I go for. So.
Well, yeah. Those are good too. So any last words of wisdom to share with leadershifters about really any of the shifts that you've experienced over the years in your career and leadership journey?
Well, as I look back and I think about it, you know, and we're still shifting. I mean, I'm still trying to, you know, my latest shift is now to have my organization get away from being flat to being hierarchical. And that's a bit of a challenge, but that's what I'm working on right now. But as far as the advice, I would say is don't be afraid to try something. I mean, I think making a decision is better than delaying a decision.
Yep.
So just make the decision, have a fallback plan if you need it, but go forward because you're going to learn so much from that. Just for making that decision. That sounds a little overplayed, but you know, that's I think proof is in the pudding here.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, a lot of times indecision is what keeps people stuck because they're waiting to make the perfect decision with no risk. And it's like, well, the world doesn't work that way, right? We don't have a crystal ball that enables us to say, oh, if I take that path, everything will work out 100% perfectly, right? Yet so many people stay frozen in indecision. Almost nothing's irreversible. So I agree. Just try it.
And I think I learned that on the trading floor, is that if I stand there and not make a trade, I'm definitely not going to make any money.
That's right.
You know, you're not going to make any money whatsoever.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then, you know, you make a trade and it's a winner or it's a loser, you know,
right.
I mean,
well, and then you make another trade and another trade, right? It's.
Yeah. And you know, you got all the disciplines of saying, okay, I'm in this position. Should I sell out now or not? And you know, the discipline is, well, you know, if if I didn't have this position on, would I buy or sell at this point? That's the mindset you have to get yourself into. And I think that goes through to any kind of decision you have to make in your life. You know, you got here and this is the position I'm in and I need to make another change. Should I, if I didn't have this position on, what would my decision be?
That is actually one of the coaching questions in another format that I use with clients. And I love the trading nuance to the way you are, you know, think about it. You know, like if I didn't have it, would I buy or sell right now? I always say, like, if you were starting from scratch right now, what would you do? Or something like that. Or in a perfect world, you know, if you didn't have all the other factors that are clouding your decision-making process, you could just do anything. And what would you do? So that you're also a coach and maybe you didn't know it.
Well, you can't think about the money either, right? I mean, that's, you know, if you have a big loser, a big winner, you can't think about the money in your next decision. That you got to take that off the table.
Yeah. So not be attached, because if you stay attached to an old decision, it's going to preclude you from making new decisions to move you forward.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, gosh, thank you so much for your insight today. I think this was brilliant. I'm just going to do a couple of bullet points by recap of all the fabulous learning that we had today. So first of all, I'm going to sort of start with what you ended with, which was, don't be afraid to make a change. And what I love about what Jim described was his shifts actually, while they might seem extreme, they really weren't, because you took an inventory of things that you like to do and were good at, both things that you were already getting paid for and things you sort of did on the side, and parlayed it into a successful business. And I think not enough people take the time to step back if they're not happy doing what they're doing and say, okay, you know what? I've got all these transferable skills and interests that I can use to make a change, and then go for it and see what happens. Of course, we have your recommendation about the book Lazy Leadership by Andrew Wilkinson, and sort of the related inspiration of Ray Dalio in terms of thinking of your business like a machine. And I'll ask that question again: what gears, what pieces of your machine are missing or aren't working? And let's start to fix those right away. And lazy leadership, by the way, doesn't really mean lazy, does it? It means stepping back and not doing it all your goddamn self, right? At hiring the people to do things and actually delegating and letting people who are good at their respective functional areas do their jobs and setting them up for success. And then the third thing that I want to highlight are just the elements of culture that have allowed Jim and Connemara to be so successful over 21 years, both in growing the business and retaining high caliber loyal employees. So the culture around it's okay to fail, right? I mean, assuming the failure isn't, you know, ill-intentioned, right? Failure in the spirit of trying new things and innovating, right? That's good and should be encouraged, not punished, either actively or passively. And then, of course, the culture of balance and appreciating that people have lives outside of work and focusing on the results, right? Does it work or does it not work? Did they produce the results or didn't they? Has nothing to do with FaceTime in the office. So I think those are all amazing things that you've instituted. My hat is tipped to you, because I work with a lot of leaders and CEOs who have not learned some or any of these lessons, quite frankly. So thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
If anybody has any questions for you, what's the best way to reach you?
JCDowns@Connemara.com.
Fabulous. Okay. Jim, thanks again. Leadershifters, thanks for joining us today. We will see you next time on the Leadership Show. In the meantime, if you have any comments or suggested guests, you know how to hit me up. Hello at theleadershiftproject.com. Till next time.